House Committee on Revenue, Tuesday, April 13, 1999, 8:30 a.m., Hearing Room A, Work Session, House Bill 2129, Public Hearing and Possible Work Session, House Bill 2947, House Bill 2948, House Bill 2949, House Bill 2950, Tape 128, Side A.
Hey, good morning. Open House Revenue for Tuesday morning. Yeah, going to open a work session on 2129, House Bill 2129. Our friend, Urban Renewal and Related Issues. And we have more amendments before us. Who's there? Can you tell us what has changed and where we are?
Can we still back the members of the committee? This is Martin Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office, and we have a guest 8 now and a guest 9. And I guess I'll just start in with the guest 8. With the guest 8, it just says that on page 15, which is the section 20, I think it is, where we were dealing with the with the issue of the exemption and, you know, whether determining the maximum assessed value after a particular exemption had been disqualified. So this section has been deleted, lines 8 through 11, which was just a little portion that was dealing with determining the maximum assessed value. So now that has been alleviated, and it should solve the controversy that was in that particular section 21. Now.
Okay, any questions from the committee members about what that is? Okay, no problem.
Okay. So now with the dash 9 amendment, 2129-9, this is dealing with, is adding a new section in, and this is what Ms. Simpson was talking about at the last meeting. And it's changing what's going to be going on the property tax statement. And so the first section, your section 28 here of the dash 9 amendment, is just saying what the county assessor here is going to have to compute. Okay, now this is some additional things that they will have to compute each year in order to put this on the tax statement. This will just be used in the tax statement, at least at this particular time. Now what they're doing is they're multiplying the billing tax rate of each of the taxing districts times the incremental value of each urban renewal area that is in the district. Then they're taking that total levy amount of excess taxes or incremental taxes the urban renewal agency has and dividing it by the total assessed value. Total assessed value being the incremental value of the urban renewal agency plus the assessed value of that particular taxing district to get a rate. So this will be like a new rate that will be put on the tax statement. And that will just be the rate that the urban renewal excess value is generating on that particular property. Then it will be summed up for each taxing district for the urban renewal in that area. Now that's basically what this section 28 is doing. Then we're defining, again, what billing tax rate is and consolidated billing tax rate is. Then in section 29, it's discussing about the timber offset rate. And this was something else that she wanted to have on the tax statement was to have the what is this timber offset rate each year and how much is it affecting that permanent rate and the actual amount that is generated on this year taxes. So we have the incremental value and then we have the timber offset rate. And then in section 30, this is just the implementation section as far as what's going to go on the tax statement. And then on page 4, the subsection 5 and then section C, D, and E, this is where it's basically talking about what it will go on the tax statement. Currently, under law, you have to have the real market value of the property and the property's assessed value. But this would then be adding in this urban renewal rate for each urban renewal area, and it'll be this rate that the excess value generates and then you'll have a rate for each tax and district bonded indebtedness, and then you've got the total timber offset rate that will be included also.
Okay, and all these amendments are basically the next year's write-up of the suggestions that Ms. Simpson brought to us in her testimony of April 7th.
Yeah, that's very good objection. Okay, so that's basically, and he does have another section here, 31, where it's just talking about an analysis of the impact of the urban renewal plan, and then you'll take into consideration these urban renewal rates that are calculated now in analyzing this impact, throwing out the urban renewal plan.
Mr. Chair.
All right.
Well, on the dash nines, I understand where we're going with that, but do we have some testimony this morning from either the department or from an assessor as to the feasibility of including this in the statement? And my understanding that the assessors are going to have somebody here who can talk about that. So, is anybody here representing the assessors? Gil, are you the closest? Do you know if some assessor type is going to be here? Okay, well, we'll hold off on hearing from an assessor then for a few minutes, but yes, Representative Shiller, that was,
yeah, okay.
That was the intent to have some discussion about that.
Mr. Chair?
Is there a rest?
This bill has been especially challenging for me. I think maybe baseball season here, but I'm having trouble keeping track of the players without the program. At the moment, the active amendments are, okay, the dash six amendment was one particular solution between the City of Portland and the Department of Revenue and the urban renewal folks, but dash sixes are now being superseded by the dash eights.
No, actually, the dash sixes talked about urban renewal subject to impression, and I think there's a bit of a consensus between AORA and at least the City of Portland about that. So I'm not sure we want to adopt the dash six, or we just want to leave it the way it is.
Okay.
So can you, Marge, can you and Mr. Tashman clarify what your interest is at this point? And
morning, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mark Corey, representing the City of Portland, and with me are Jeff Cashman, representing AORA, and Linda Meng, representing the City's City Attorney's Office. We have prepared a Dash 10 amendment, which Representative Corey has passed out. We just got it this morning. The LC drafters apparently had a baby last Friday, and so some of the things were coming out of LC a little slowly. We apologize to the committee for that. Ms. Meng will describe very briefly the agreement that we worked out with AR, which is represented in the Dash 10 amendment.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Meng. I'm with the Portland City Attorney's Office. We are proposing the Dash 10 amendments, which would delete subsection 7 of section 23 of the bill, which talk about the compression of urban renewal. In line with the chair's suggestion of the last hearing, that AORA and the city get together along with Ms. Simpson and other interested parties to work on urban renewal during the interim, we are recommending and suggesting to these amendments that all of the urban renewal portions of the bill be relegated to that position where we would work on them all during the interim so that we could come back with something in the next session, and so we would recommend taking this section out that's in there now and moving all of these into a later consideration. And that's the best 10 amendments too.
Okay, so what they would do in essence is preserve the implementation begin under Measure 50 for the next biennium until you all come back and give us some other information.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and it's our understanding that the Department of Revenue will continue to do what they did this past tax year.
Okay. Mr. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Jeff Tashman representing AORA, and AORA's interest is served by not having the compression methodology written into statute, and AORA is satisfied with having the department continue its administrative authority to do compression the way it has been done this year, until and unless there are some legislative changes.
Okay.
So we spent a lot of time and kind of came back to where we started, in essence, but we know that we have to get somewhere else, I suppose, next time. Okay, any questions from the committee? Everybody understand kind of where we're going with this?
Where does that leave us with 6, 7, and 8 then?
Well, 6 would be replaced by 10.
Yeah.
7 we want to move because it talks about the issues relating to the manufactured home as well as the timing issue. 8, I think we want to adopt because there was obviously drafting confusion in terms of special assessment, which was brought forward by Mr. DiLorenzo and pointed out that it appeared to talk about special assessments on real property and not just rezoning. And then the -9s were the requests of Mrs. Simpson, and the -10s are the Portland AORA compromise, or at least status quo for now. So if I understand everything correctly, we still have those amendments alive, 7, 8, 9, and 10, depending on what the committee wants to do. Is that correct, Lisa?
Yep.
Okay. Do you have any other comments?
Mr. Chair, I would just like to reinforce Ms. Mank's comment about the -9 amendments being really fairly complex and opening a whole host of questions, and AORA feels that it would be much more meaningful context to deal with those in the interim as opposed to in the context of this bill.
Okay, thank you. Thanks. Ms. Simpson, do you want to tell us what you have in the -9? I mean, we already know what it is. You gave it to us the other day, but make the case for them.
Okay. Of all the things that I'd like to see, I'm Pat Simpson from Bandon. Mr. Chairman, of all things I'd like to see changed in urban renewal, I carefully selected just those two because they would show the impact of urban renewal on the taxpayers. And I can see the wisdom of putting it off and doing a complete look at urban renewal, but this is really our foot in the door to say, look, this really impacts us. My personal tax bill was 13% higher than it would have been if we had not had urban renewal in our county. And they're adding new urban renewal agencies all the time. That's going to affect the taxing districts all the time. They're going to start losing money. So I would be very disappointed if we wouldn't get some kind of a statement on the tax bill so that people become more aware. Most people get the tax bill and they just pay it. Sometimes they sort of look at it. So if they say, why am I paying anything to an urban renewal area in that city of the north? You know, that type of thing, then they're going to be more aware of it. So I'll certainly go by whatever you decide, but, you know, I would be really disappointed because this was to show the impact so that everybody became aware. I think just having the opportunity to bring it up here has perhaps had some impact because I think maybe certainly the chairman is more aware of the impact and things concerning urban renewal, and I think maybe the rest of the committee is too. I certainly appreciate all your attention on a very difficult subject. If you want to take something the easy way, the taxes, I mean, you have compression and you have urban renewal, you know, it's getting a bit complicated, so I decided, well, the simplest thing is just get rid of urban renewal, but I know we can't do that. So thank you very much. Any other questions?
All ideas are welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Why don't you wait there for a moment, and we'll see if there's any questions from the committee specifically.
Thank you. Not so much a question, but a comment. I want to thank the citizen for coming up again. We worked at the last session, and among citizen lobbyists, I think you're one of the most effective that we see in the building. My only comment about the dash line, if we're going to be putting the urban renewal piece back to a work group in the interim, and if the dash nine is addressed, basically how that appears on a statement, that is, and it all relates to how urban renewal is working, it may be best to delay implementation of that until we've done the work group on urban renewal, because if things change, well, then whatever we do here, we're going to have to reprogram and amend again next session. So that's my only thinking, that it may be worth waiting for to make the effort to get that all geared up until we finish the work of the urban renewal work group.
Okay, thank you. Other comments? Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Chairman, I'm reading through these amendments. Have we anywhere dealt with the change in the bill where taxes on personal property, the lien date moves from July 1 to January 1? Is that still in the bill, or has that been amended out?
Okay, second. Why don't we stay with this urban renewal issue just for a moment, and then we'll get to other questions.
Okay.
Jim Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to advocate for Mr. Simpson's proposal, because I do think that taxpayers can more fully participate in the public process if they're informed about whether their funds are going. And I think it's almost a useful step to set the foundation for the discussion in the next session. And if there aren't complicating, I realize how this is such a web of inner complexities, but if there aren't, if it doesn't create problems in some way that it's not yet apparent to me, I would support her proposals.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
I'm going to say I'm fairly comfortable with letting this particular issue float into the interim work group. I get very concerned if we're going to go in there and if there's unintended consequences given the time that we're working with now. I do appreciate the work you've brought forward in this amendment, and I think the concept behind it we definitely need to continue to pursue, but I would be comfortable letting this concept float into the work group.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the comments of the committee. I think there's real value in having your concept grafted into this kind of language. I guess I share the concern of Representative Shetterly in another dimension, and that is in part of this whole process is to educate and inform the taxpayers, which I think is extremely beneficial. I support completely. My concern, though, is if we start an education process now based on what it is today, and then that changes in a year and a half or 2 years, it takes a long time for people to grasp something. And if we say, here's the situation, and then it changes, I think we'd actually create more confusion. But I certainly do support this concept. I think that every tax statement ought to have an explanation of how much is going to urban renewal and the other analysis of the rates and all those things that you're talking about. But I do think that it would be best if we said, next session, here's a package for urban renewal and the explanation and the requirements on the tax statement that reflect what those agreements are. So I think that would be my feeling at this point.
Thank you very much.
Yes, well, we all appreciate the work that you've done and the time that you put in on it, and we're all amazed that you are interested. But, nevertheless, I think you're doing this, and it will have benefit for the taxpayers, ultimately, to be informed.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for coming today.
Thank you.
Okay, so Representative Witt, your comment then.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm looking through the amendments, and it seems to me, unless I'm missing something, that in Section 14, we have continued with the change in moving the lien date on personal property to January 1, where previously it had been July the 1st, and the only exception was for manufactured homes. Am I reading that correctly?
That's very right. You are.
Okay, I guess my question then becomes, why do we have a change in the lien date for personal property and not for manufactured homes? And how will that affect taxpayers?
Jim, will you be able to help us out with that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Maneri with the Department of Revenue. Representative Witt, the part of the testimony that you had was from, I believe it was from Diane Belt from Washington County. And as you were going through that, she said that in terms of the manufactured homes issue, it wasn't, she was asked if it was very significant, and she said, well, no, there aren't a large number of those. And her concern, her main concern was the problem with businesses that either went bankrupt during the 6 month period and they didn't have a lien, so they couldn't get priority, or businesses that were basically closing up and selling off their assets that they knew about, and again, they didn't have a lien to try to collect some of the taxes. And that was the testimony. So,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Jim, if I can ask you this question. If a business sells its assets, or sells its corporation, or sells its assets on January the 15th of a particular year, with this change, the lien would have attached January 1st.
That's correct.
So to convey title, to convey clear title to those assets, the taxes would have to be paid for what period of time?
The taxes would have to be paid during January. The taxes would have to be paid for the coming tax year, because the assessment date's January 1 for the coming tax year.
Which would be how many months in that case?
Would be, it would be, well, it would be about 6 months till the beginning of the tax year. It would be about 9 or 10 months prior to when the taxes normally would be paid with the property tax statement.
In November?
In November, yes.
Okay, so that would, if I can, Mr. Chair, that would require the party who is selling the corporate assets that are taxable to pay those taxes 10 months in advance to be able to give clear title.
That's correct.
Okay.
And with the current date of July, how much in advance would, if somebody sold something in January using that same scenario, what's the difference, current law versus the proposed?
Well, Mr. Chair, in current law, they have no lien. So they basically couldn't collect the tax. The assets would be gone. They're selling the assets off. It's just a practical collection issue.
Well, and I'm thinking in practical terms, if I'm representing a seller of personal property, let's say in that circumstance, we would prorate the tax liability so that the purchaser is going to be responsible, and you would make that part of the transaction, that the purchaser would be responsible for the prepayment of taxes if the purchaser is getting title prior to the beginning of the coming tax year. So the prepayment is still required, but if the purchaser is acquiring title, then you're going to assign that responsibility to the purchaser and not to the seller.
So the county, the county cares if they get paid.
Right.
It's the parties that can allocate that responsibility between themselves as part of the sale transaction. It would be normal in that case that, again, if the title and possession are going to transfer before the beginning of the next tax year, that you'd allocate that responsibility to the purchaser to pay, since the purchaser is going to have the possession and use of the property.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Well, I think technically, Representative Shetterly, what would happen is that if you sold those assets in January, the bill comes out in fall, they're due in November, the new business, new owners of those assets would end up paying the tax. I mean, the assets haven't disappeared. The assets are owned by somebody else who then pays the taxes for the tax year. But, mean, if you sell the assets in January, under the current law, there's not a lien on those assets, a tax lien. The bill comes out in September or October. In November, the new owner of the assets, in their case, the purchaser ends up paying the taxes. Wouldn't that be correct?
For the tax year beginning
July 1,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Jim Maneri, the bill would go to the seller because that's who owned the assets on the assessment date. If the assets were still, if you could discover where the assets were, if they were sold off and they're still in state, the lien does attach on July 1. You'd have to chase it down. Sometimes with business sales, they'll have auctions, and you can have out-of-state buyers come in with equipment, stuff, and move it. So again, it's really a practical collection issue for the county.
Mr. Chairman,
all right.
Yeah, I appreciate that. My concern is we have taxes being paid 10 or 11 months earlier than when they're due to be paid, for the convenience of the county in terms of collecting the taxes, and I'm concerned about that.
Do they have to be collected, or could that lien remain and be due at the later date when the tax bills go out?
Mr. Chair, the lien would attach July 1, and again, it's for the most part, for businesses that are shutting down and selling their assets, it's just a matter of the county even finding where those assets are after they're sold.
I think there's some practicality involved here. I certainly understand.
Mr. Chairman, many of these involve sales of assets and sales of businesses. In those cases, what we're doing is we're requiring these corporations to pay their taxes 10 months early.
And what would your solution be?
Leave it alone. Leave it as it is. We'll leave the taxes July 1st.
And assets that disappear?
There's always a risk that assets can disappear. I don't think it justifies having taxpayers pay taxes 10 months earlier than when they're due.
Okay. Anybody else have any comment about that? Thank you. Yeah. Gilda, do you find anybody yet? Okay. I kind of think, though, that the consensus of the discussion was to postpone that adoption of that amendment, but you're welcome to go ahead and speak to it anyway.
129?
The -9s were the issues that we were discussing.
Mr. Chairman Kovac, members of the committee, I'm Doug Ebner, Marion County Assessor. I understand the purpose of this bill, and us as assessors would like to have everything put on the table as much as possible. One thing we've learned in dealing with Measure 5 is sometimes you put too much information on a tax bill, and it becomes so confusing to the taxpayer that they're not sure what amount to pay. I had one gal that called up and said, I can't afford to pay all my taxes this year. I said, well, how much are they? And she said, $34,000. That's the value of her property. The more information we put on that tax bill, the more confusing it comes to people of what amount to pay. I have no problem with putting information on the people. We try to do a number of series of newspaper articles to inform people of what's happening, what their taxes are, and how we got there. I think her renewal first of it came up when Kaiser had a special levy. Several other districts in the state had special levies for her renewal that went beyond the amount of money they could normally collect. That showed up on the tax bill and brought a lot of attention to that. I think that's good. Make people aware of where their tax dollars are going. I'm not sure everything should go on the tax bill, though. I think some things could go in a newspaper article and list the things you want to say and what it costs per year would be a better approach and keep the bill less confusing as possible. Any questions?
Okay, well, it sounds like your opinion, but I guess the question that we had was how would it be possible and how much calculation time, et cetera, would be involved.
Anything is possible. We could calculate that because we calculated the special levy for the urban renewal district already last year, and we were able to do that. At least within our system, we could. I assume we could on the rest of urban renewal. We wanted a special rate for that. I haven't read over the complete bill. I'm not sure how the forest land part of this works when you get into to page 4. I just seen it here about 2 minutes ago, so I haven't got a chance to review it totally, but I'm assuming we can make the urban renewal part of it work.
Well, our discussion before you got here, I appreciate you coming in, our discussion has been that I think there's general consensus on the committee that it is worthwhile to have disclosed on the tax statement how much is going to urban renewal, what their rate is, etc. But the discussion was that we are going to have a work group through the interim that's going to come up with some long-term recommendations for urban renewal districts, and rather than start out with one explanation and calculation based on current law and then change them, because as you said, people do get confused, especially if we change the law. I think there will be a recommendation to do that. I don't think it justifies having taxpayers pay taxes 10 months earlier than when they're due.
Okay. Anybody else have any comment about that? Thank you.
Yeah. Bill, did you find anybody yet? Okay. I kind of think, though, that the consensus of the discussion was to postpone that adoption of that amendment, but you're welcome to go ahead and speak to it anyway.
129?
The dash 9s were the issue that we were discussing.
Mr. Chairman Probeck, member of the committee, I'm Doug Ebner, Marion County Assessor. I understand the purpose of this bill, and the assessors would like to have everything put on the table as much as possible. One thing we've learned in dealing with Measure 5 is sometimes you put too much information on a tax bill, and it becomes so confusing to the taxpayer that they're not sure what amount to pay. I had one gal that called up and said, I can't afford to pay all my taxes this year. I said, well, how much are they? And she said, $34,000. That's the value of her property. The more information we put on that tax bill, the more confusing it comes to people of what amount to pay. I have no problem with putting information out in front of people. We try to do a number of series of newspaper articles to inform people of what's happening and what their taxes are and how we got there. I think urban renewal first of it came up when Kaiser had a special levy. Several other districts in the state had special levies for urban renewal that went beyond the amount of money they could normally collect. They showed up on the tax bill and brought a lot of attention to that. I think that's good. Makes people aware of where their tax dollars are going. I'm not sure everything should go on the tax bill, though. I think some things could go in a newspaper article, unless the things you want to say and what it costs per year would be a better approach and keep the bill less confusing as possible. Any questions?
Okay, well, it sounds like your opinion, but I guess the question that we had was how would it be possible and how much calculation time, et cetera, would be involved?
Anything is possible. We could calculate that because we calculated the special levy for the urban renewal district already last year, and we were able to do that. At least within our system, we could. I assume we could on the rest of urban renewal. We wanted a special rate for that. I haven't read over the complete bill. I'm not sure how the forest land part of this works when you get into to page 4. I just seen it here about 2 minutes ago, so I haven't got a chance to review it totally, but I'm assuming we can make the urban renewal part of it work.
Well, our discussion before you got here, I appreciate you coming in, our discussion has been that I think there's general consensus on the committee that it is worthwhile to have disclosed on the tax statement how much is going to a renewal, what their rate is, etc. But the discussion was that we are going to have a work group through the interim that's going to come up with some long-term recommendations for urban renewal districts, and rather than start out with one explanation and calculation based on current law and then change that, because as you said, people do get confused, and especially if we change the law, I think there will be a recommendation to do that once this is a resolved issue, but probably not right now under current law. So you can start preparing for that for a couple of years down the line.
Right. I think it'll be done.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, well, let's see, where are we going to go with this bill? I think are we ready to adopt some amendments here?
I'm ready.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay, we're in work session?
Yes, we are.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the -7 amendments to House Bill 2129.
Okay, Rasmussen moves adoption of the -7 amendments to House Bill 2129. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the -8 amendments to House Bill 2129.
Representative Rasmussen moves adoption of the -8 amendments to House Bill 2129. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the -10 amendments to House Bill 2129.
And Representative Rasmussen moves adoption of the -10 amendments to House Bill 2129. Is there any discussion on that? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Move House Bill 2129 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation as long as I'm not the one who's carrying it.
You may have to amend your motion. Okay, Representative Rasmussen moves House Bill 2129 as amended by the 7, 8, and 10 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any more discussion?
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Representative West.
Yeah, I'm going to be voting against the bill because of the change in the bill that will require taxpayers to pay personal property taxes as much as 10 months earlier than when they otherwise would be due.
Okay, further discussion? You know, Representative Wood, I think you raised an interesting question. I guess the issue is who's going to get harmed, you know, with either one of these scenarios. And I think some of the testimony has been that these assets do tend to disappear. However, I'm sympathetic to your point, and I do think it is a bit of a stretch to be paying in advance that far out. So, I would entertain actually a conceptual amendment, if you want, on line 42 of the printed bill to...
Which page, sir?
Page 8, line 42, to retain July rather than January.
Do we need to pull back the motion to the floor?
I'm not sure. I think if we did a conceptual, we should actually conceptually adopt the -7. Representative Rasmussen, would you amend your motion or withdraw your
motion?
Wait a minute. Chair moves for unanimous consent to reconsider the vote by which we adopted the -7 amendments. Is there any discussion, any objection? So ordered. So Representative Rasmussen, would you move the conceptual adoption of the -7.
I will, as soon as I finish. I move the conceptual adoption of the -7 since I figure out the rest of the language you need in this amendment.
Right, because that's the section that the...
Which page in the amendment? Oh, I see. Is it line 8?
No, I think what we need to do is adopt the -7 conceptually and then... adopt the, or first of all, before we go there, let me ask the committee, are we getting some consensus on this July-January issue? I'd like to know that.
I'm a little confused.
Okay. the issue, I think, before us is whether we want to go with the January date or the July date in terms of this last discussion regarding the personal property liens.
I guess I've, Mr. Chair, forgotten why the department wanted to change it from July to January.
Jim?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Maneri with the Department of Revenue. That again is the personal property is the collection problem of selling the property between January and July. It's assessed to the owner on January 1st, and if it's sold in that 6-month period, there's no lien for collection purposes. So the property is sold off. The lien then doesn't attach till July 1, and the property tax statement comes out in October, and the assets are gone. So when the assessor's office discovers that a sale is going on, they have no lien yet to go attach the property and try to get some of the proceeds to collect the tax. It is for the upcoming tax year.
Mr. Chair.
Just saying, the representative of the board did answer your question.
So, are they actually paying the tax then on January 1 with the changes that you've recommended? That's when the lien attaches.
Representative Kapoor, they would be paying the tax during that 6-month period. It could be January, it could be June. It's whenever their sale's taking place, they're going to pre-collect the taxes because the assets will no longer be there, and the owner to whom it was assessed on January isn't the owner anymore.
Mr. Chair, Lieutenant Merkley. I'm looking back to, Jim, your description of Section 14, which, am I in the right section on this?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I believe it is.
And you know that the assessment date was moved from July 1st to January 1st. You talk about the assessment date. Are we talking about the beginning of the tax year having been moved to January 1st?
Representative Merkley, no, the tax year is always July 1 to June 30th.
What is the significance of the assessment date?
Representative Merkley, prior to Measure 5, the assessment date was historically has been placed at January 1st because 6 months ahead of the tax year because it allows a normal allows a normal time period for the assessor's office to gather data on the assets and on the assessment. You know who it's going to be assessed. You know who owns it on January 1st. And what property...
So the significance of the assessment date is determining who will receive the tax bill.
That's a part of it, and the other part is what property is in this case, in the county on January 1st. If you wait till July... When we went to Measure 5, the language of Measure 5 forced the legislature to change the assessment date to July 1st. And what that means... Now, for homeowners, that doesn't make a big difference. The homes stay there, but... Especially for business property, it meant that we had to wait till July 1st for businesses to determine even what assets they had, and then we had a very short time period until the tax statements came out to do the work. It was changed back with Measure 50 to allow a longer time period.
Do you have another question, Representative?
Just to make sure I understand it then. What we did was say on January 1st, the amount of property you have is what you will be taxed on in the following tax year, which will begin July 1st, 6 months later. And so we create this time lag into which falls the types of problems that Representative Witt is referring to.
Representative Merkley, that's true on the lien is for collection purposes. And what Representative Witt says is true is that in property changing hands during that 6-month period, we do have that collection issue in terms of the lien.
Any other questions, Representative Merkley?
Representative Wynn.
Jim, isn't it true that in the normal situation, let's say a business sells its assets on January the 15th of a given year. In the normal situation, the bill for that tax year was due on November 15th. Isn't that correct?
That's
the previous November 15th. So those taxes typically would have been paid on November 15th.
Representative Wick, for that, yes, you're in the middle of that tax year, and that's true.
So, and those taxes that were paid on November 15th would have covered the tax year up through June 30th.
That's correct.
So, the next payment is due November 15th the following year. So for those assets that were sold on January 15th, those taxes had already been paid typically through June 30th.
That's correct.
Under this bill, if I can continue, under this bill, with the change that's proposed in this bill, to give clear title to the new purchaser, the seller is going to have to pay the taxes not only through June 30th of that year, but for the succeeding year.
Representative Witt, either the sellers or the parties in the transaction will have to pay the taxes for the upcoming year
to give clear title.
That's true.
Okay.
Okay, is everybody in agreement?
Oh, we're in agreement. But
yeah, we agreed you're going to carry this bill.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay, well, we unadopted the dash sevens. We reconsidered that.
Moving the dash sevens in a conceptual, as a conceptual amendment.
Is there agreement on that? Go back to July. You know what I think? I think we had a shelve just for a day or two.
Okay.
Michael Brown.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
My overall sense is that I kind of see personal property taxes as being almost a self-reporting event. I'm not overly concerned about where the dates fall. I think that DeWitt's got a very interesting question going here, and maybe it would help if I had a written timeline or some sort of layout of what bars are on what areas, but I can be know about which date it is.
Well, what I'm going to request staff to do to have a dash, I guess it would be 11.
Good.
That would have that would be essentially the dash 7s with the July dates incorporated.
Okay.
And so then we'll have a choice.
All right. So we have not withdrawing any motions on the dash 7, and I've withdrawn the motion to the floor.
Yes. We reconsidered the vote by which we adopted dash 7.
Right.
And so you're now withdrawing your motion to move the bill to the floor.
I'm withdrawing the motion to move the bill to the floor. I'm withdrawing the conceptual motion.
Okay.
I'm just very kind of withdrawn into my shell mode today.
Okay. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Merkley, I think what it boils down to is that it's more convenient for the taxpayers involved if it's a July 1st date, but it is more convenient and securitized better for the Department of Revenue with the earlier date. And I guess the piece we have to wrestle with is it how much of an inconvenience really is it to taxpayers that capitalize it or something like that.
Mr. Chair, now Representative Murphy, I think there's a little bit different way of looking at it, and that is it good public policy, and is it fair to require taxpayers to pay taxes 10 months earlier than when they otherwise are due? I think that's really the heart of the issue.
And that would occur only if there's a sale in that time period, right?
That's correct, yes.
And if I could just clarify with Mr. McNary, it is not an option simply for the buyer to agree to accept responsibility. Indeed, the taxes for the future year do have to be paid off in full at the point of the transaction, at the point of sale.
For the record, Jim and Mary, Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, your question is to the buyer. At the time of the sale of this property, say the sale occurs on February 1st or somewhere in that period,
does it trigger the necessity of paying the lien off at that point? Or can the buyer take responsibility for that?
But under current law, the lien would not have attached. It attaches July 1.
Right, but under your proposal, it would have attached.
Yes, that's correct.
And to unattach it, it's attached to the property, but it would have attached to the prior owner who owned it January 1st on the assessment date.
For personal property, you can go against the property, and there's a personal liability on the taxpayer. If the taxpayer has the assets.
So if Mr. Witt is selling me something on February 1st, is there any way in our transaction that we can easily handle this, or in fact, do we have to pay off the tax for the following year at that moment?
So you're asking,
sale on February
1st, could you prepay the tax?
Are we required to prepay the tax upon sale on February 1st? The lien is attached.
Under
your proposal?
Yes.
So, okay.
Then, I mean, what happens up in that market is if the assessor's office discovers that the sale is taking place, they can go in and attach the property and collect from the proceeds because they have a lien. And as Representative Witt has stated, then to get clear title to the assets, you would have to pay off the lien.
Well, I concur with Representative on this. Sure. Okay, any other comments?
I think one of the little pieces of data that would be helpful to see is the number of, typical county, the number of times that something is sold in this case and the resolution of it, whether the tax is collected or whether the assets disappear and how much is uncollected. So in other words, how much is due in a particular time period and how much is actually collected. So we can see if there, you know, if 90% of the tax is being skipped on and evaded, then we might want to consider this. If it's the other way around and 90% is being paid, then leave it the way it is.
Mr. Chair, my biggest concern here is that businesses get sold all the time. And when you sell a business, you sell assets that go with that business. And my concern here is requiring payment up to 10 months in advance when you sell a business.
Well, I'm willing to go that way if we see evidence that there's a significant problem. I don't think we should be making decisions, though, just strictly on the basis of hunches or feelings without at least some data that says whether there is or isn't a problem. But I also agree with the concept here that paying taxes that are due 10 months into the future does not sound like dealing fair with the public, unless there's a demonstrated issue of the taxes not being paid. Okay, thank you. We'll close the work session in our house for 2129. We'll unfortunately have this back again. And I want to open a public hearing on House Bill 2947. And I appreciate the folks who've been coming here regularly on this issue. And I have a sign-up sheet for today, but if you signed up previous days, I also retained those, but I don't know if everybody who signed up on previous days is actually here. So what I'm going to do, since we do have some time today, is start with the sign-up sheet that we have for today, and then I'll go back into the ones from previous days. The first person on the list is John Savage.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Savage, the Administrator of the Office of Energy and the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm going to cover three energy tax credits that are proposed for elimination that we run at the Office of Energy. They are the Business Energy Tax Credit, Section 1.142,
the Residential Energy Tax Credit 1.141 and the State Home Oil Weatherization Lenders Credit 1.143. We're providing you a one-page fact sheet on each of these tax credits. First, the Business Energy Tax Credit. The purpose of this credit is to encourage businesses to invest in energy efficient equipment and production processes. The credit goes for conservation projects, renewable resources, recycling, and alternative fuel vehicles. As of year end 1998, we estimate that the businesses who have invested in conservation through this credit have saved more than 14 trillion BTU of energy and have cut their energy bills by about $100 million a year. For electricity, the savings through the credit are equivalent to a power plant. For all forms of energy, the savings are equivalent to the yearly energy use of about 160,000 households. Beyond the energy and dollar savings, there are other benefits. The recycling projects have recovered at least 17 million tons of aluminum, cardboard, newspaper, glass, wood, paper, and plastic, most of which would have gone to landfills otherwise. The farms and ranches, many of the tax credits have gone for energy-efficient irrigation systems that not only save energy, but reduce water use by at least 20%. Credit also goes for the weatherization of rental housing. With the help of the credit, landlords have weatherized more than 40,000 rentals. One last point on this credit. We've taken a number of steps to keep the credit an incentive rather than a reward. First, a business must get a project approved by us before any equipment can be purchased. Second, we review each application to make sure the energy savings are at least 10%, and in some cases 25% beyond what is standard practice. If they're not, they're not eligible for credit. Third, any projects required by law are not eligible, and neither are those that pay back in less than a year. Last, the credit only goes for the incremental cost of the energy efficiency equipment beyond what a business would pay otherwise for standard equipment. In the handout provided is a one-pager of recent projects, I think, that illustrates the kinds of businesses that use the tax credit and the variety of projects they help finance. Residential Energy Tax Credit, this is 1.141. One of the main purposes of this credit is to encourage households to invest in renewable resource systems. These are solar or geothermal space and water heating systems and photovoltaic systems. Today, these systems are eligible for a tax credit up to $1,500. Through 1998, about 20,000 households have installed some kind of renewable resource system due to this credit, and most of those are solar water heating systems. Last session, this credit was amended to include tax credits for alternative fuel vehicles and highly efficient appliances. Appliance use accounts for about half of home energy use, and the intent of the credit is sort of to jumpstart a demand so the market develops for these highly efficient appliances and prices come down. The tax credit is based on the amount of actual savings up to 25% of the cost of the appliance. Today, the eligible appliances are for clothes washers, dishwashers, refrigerators, and water heating systems. And depending on the type of the appliance, eligible models are 20 to 60% more efficient than conventional ones. In 1998, the first year of eligibility, more than 9,000 households bought a highly efficient appliance and received a tax credit. Last, the tax credit for lenders. This is 1.143. Since the early 1980s, by law, Oregon's electric and natural gas utilities have provided free energy audits and loans or rebates to the residential customers to weatherize their homes.
Excuse me, Mr. Sandwich, is that what you show is, that's not the show program, is it?
Yes, it is. 1.143.
Okay.
The State Home Oil Weatherization Program, or SHOW program, which we run, was established to ensure that households that heat with oil or wood have access to comparable incentives. The interest rate on the SHOW loan is 6.5%. Cash credit goes to commercial banks who provide the loan, and the credit is equal to the difference between the 6.5% rate the homeowner pays and a prevailing market interest rate. Since 1982, about 4,400 households have used the loan to finance weatherization measures. That concludes my testimony.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Mr. Savage, is it your testimony that these, let's talk about the business energy, would these projects have not occurred if the tax credit did not exist?
Mr. Chair, I believe for the most part that the safeguards we've sort of built into this to make sure that it is, keep it as an incentive, I think that that's true.
And is this $5.4 million? Is this personal? Okay, so the total that's represented here is about $6.4 million less revenue because of these credits in the biennial forecast for the biennial.
Yeah. Mr. Chair?
Mr. Kapoor?
This is just a comment, but I think what is important to me about these credits is that they are... for encouraging people to go above and beyond the current law, and I think that we can see that the amount of energy that's been saved has been really dramatic. And if it was just getting people to comply with current law, it does seem like a lot of money, but we're asking people to go up above and beyond what's currently required.
That's just for the business energy program, isn't that right? That's not true of the other two programs. Is there any calculation of how much these companies have saved by reduced energy bills that they don't have to pay them?
Mr. Chair, our estimate is that for the businesses, we've ordered about 5,500 tax credits for businesses and they sort of run the gamut. From grocery stores to sawmills to food processors to landlords, and we estimate they cut their energy bills by about $100 million a year.
So they've saved $100 million as well as
clothes washers, dishwashers, refrigerators, and water heating systems. And depending on the type of the appliance, eligible models are 20 to 60% more efficient than conventional ones. In 1998, the first year of eligibility, more than 9,000 households bought a highly efficient appliance and received a tax credit. Last, the cash credit for lenders, this is 1.143. Since the early 1980s, by law, Oregon's electric and natural gas utilities have provided free energy audits and loans or rebates to their residential customers to weatherize their homes.
Excuse me, Mr. Savage, is that what you show is, that's not the SHOW program?
Yes, it is. 1.143.
Okay.
The State Home Oil Weatherization Program, or SHOW program, which we run, was established to ensure that households that heat with oil or wood have access to comparable incentives. The interest rate on a SHOW loan is 6.5%. Cash credit goes to commercial banks who provide the loan, and the credit is equal to the difference between the 6.5% rate the homeowner pays and a prevailing market interest rate. Since 1982, about 4,400 households have used the loan to finance weatherization measures. That concludes my testimony.
Okay, thank you for the questions. Mr. Savage, is it your testimony that these, let's talk about the business energy, would these projects have not occurred if the tax credit did not exist?
Mr. Chair, I believe for the most part there's a safeguard we've already built into this to make sure that it is, if it is an incentive, I think that that's true.
And, yeah, does this $5.4 million, that's going to be, is this personal? Okay, so the total that's represented here is about $6.4 million less revenue because of these credits in the biennium.
Yeah. Mr. Chair?
President Kafori?
This is just a comment, but I think what is important to me about these credits is that they are we're encouraging people to go above and beyond the current law, and I think that we can see that the amount of energy that's been saved has been really dramatic, and if it was just getting people to comply with current law, it does seem like a lot of money, but we're asking people to go up above and beyond what's currently required.
That's just for the business energy program, isn't that right? That's not true of the other two programs. Is there any calculation of how much these companies have saved by reduced energy bills that they don't have to pay then?
Mr. Chair, our estimate is that for the businesses, we've awarded about 5,500 tax credits to businesses, and they sort of run the gamut. From grocery stores to sawmills to food processors to landlords. And we estimate they've cut their energy bills by about $100 million a year.
So they've saved $100 million as well as gotten the tax credit?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Merkel.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify your statement in regard to the residential energy tax credit. That is also beyond current law, is it not?
Pardon me?
I was understanding you to respond to Representative Kafour, is that her statement that was going beyond current law only applied to the first tax credit?
And to the business energy tax credit, not to the residential energy and not to the state homeowner weatherization program.
Okay. I was just a little confused because under the residential, aren't people going beyond what they're required by law also?
Mr. Chair, Representative Markley, there's no requirement. The only requirement in law is the federal appliance efficiency standards, and these are far beyond those.
Yes, so this would be beyond FEMA. Yes.
Mr.
Okay. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Yes, we got your name.
John Savage.
Mr. Savage, looking at the examples that you give on the business energy tax credit, it looks like some of those might have been done in the course of a remodel or something that was going on otherwise. And I guess since this is a percentage, 35%, what would the effect be, say, if we were to look at reducing the percentage that's allowable as a credit? Or maybe you could talk a little more about what kind of screening goes on to ensure that we're not just subsidizing replacing lighting fixtures that would have happened anyway.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, let me start out that we've gone through a number of generations. Anything that is standard practice, we screen, is screened out. And we've probably gone, just using the lighting example, we've probably gone through several generations of lighting systems that are no longer eligible for tax credits. And beyond that, it has to save at least 10%, and in the case of lighting, I was using as an example, it has to save energy that's 25%, which is beyond standard practice or standard lighting system. The first example, to me, is a very good example on this list of projects of the type of tax credit that's available for small retail stores. Lighting is a fairly big part of their energy use. and the quality of lighting is very important to their systems. And so the energy efficient lighting systems generally reduce the lighting use from standard ones by about 50%.
Mr. Chair,
can I ask you a question?
I
don't know if I did.
Well, I think you partially did. If I could just follow up.
Sure.
If you skip to the bottom of that page and look at Fred Meyer's putting its distribution center, I mean, if that were going on, would they likely not have converted to energy efficient lighting anyway?
The Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I don't know if they would have installed the system that they ended up installing as a result of the credit. I mean, there's a whole gamut of sort of efficiency. From an efficiency perspective, there's a whole gamut of lighting systems available out there.
And they tend to get more expensive as they...
They tend to go to the more efficient system as a result.
Okay, before
you. Mr. Savage, have you noticed that corporations are, in overall energy efficiency, are doing these kind of projects without your, without these tax credits? I was under the understanding that the amount of conservation efforts that are taking place have kind of have dropped off over the years, which, is that correct?
It is correct. But in part, I mean, the sort of the alternative programs that have been available have been run by utilities. But the amount of money that they've been putting into those programs has drastically fallen since the early 1990s.
Hey, any other questions? Thank you. Senator Shields.
Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you for giving me an opportunity to come and speak before you today. I'm here to speak in opposition to House Bill 24 or 2954 and House Bill 2949. These bills would eliminate tax credits on alternative energy devices and on energy conservation measures, respectively. You're getting a copy of my testimony. I honestly believe that the minimal fiscal impact made by these programs is more than justified by the potential results of the behavior that these laws are intended to promote. These programs are not just some kind of subsidy to a special interest group or some kind of a government handout. The purpose of these programs is to offer a reasonable financial incentive to individuals to change their behavior with regard to using energy. Furthermore, these programs, by encouraging individual homeowners to purchase various alternative energy devices, are helping to promote a fledgling industry that is growing up right here in Oregon. Whether it be alternative fuel vehicles, or highly efficient appliances, or home power generating systems, there are small businesses in Oregon that can benefit from additional customers that these credits can create. There are some people who might argue that it should not be government's place to offer financial incentives to one industry over another. I reject that argument, however, as does the history of U.S. tax policy over the last 100 years. Where would the U.S. automobile industry be, for example, if federal and state governments had not spent the equivalent of billions of dollars in building roads and highways? Where would the petroleum and timber industries be today if government had not offered tax incentives to help people, to help develop lands where that were only marginally profitable? The U.S. and Oregon have a long-standing tax policy of offering tax incentives for the kind of development and the kind of economic activity that we want to promote. The tax credit program, which would be eliminated by these bills, are no different. When we consider the environmental damage which society has done to our landscape over the last 100 years, small measures like these ones to individuals and businesses who would like to pollute less seem the least we can do. In my eyes, we need to look no further than the price of gasoline to know that we would do well to decrease our reliance on fossil fuels. It would be good for the environment. It would be good for our national security. It would be good for business. For all these reasons and dozens more, I urge you to vote no on these bills. might add to my written testimony that in my own district in Portland, I've had the joy of getting to know some people involved in some of these small businesses. One small business converts gasoline-powered cars to electric. And they're fascinating to watch. Absolutely clean operating, and besides, you can sneak up on your neighbors with a car like this. They never hear you coming. They're absolutely silent vehicles. I can answer questions from my perspective. Mostly I've been involved in trying to get tax credits for individuals to do things to clean up the environment that are equivalent to those that businesses get. I mean, if a business can do it, why can't an individual do it? That's kind of been the philosophy behind what I'm doing.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions? Thanks very much.
Thank you for your time.
Wallace Rutledge.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Wallace Rutledge, and I'm the Director of Forestry Assistance with the Department of Forestry. Ray Craig was here yesterday. He couldn't be here today, so I'm sending in for Ray Craig. I'd like to testify on item 1.145, the reforestation tax credit. This is a credit that was created by the 1979 legislature and subsequently amended about five times to provide incentive for private forest landowners to invest in converting our underproducing, underproductive forest land into healthy, productive forest. And in my written testimony, there's an attachment that highlights those amendments. The tax credit started out with 10% for real small woodland owners and is now at 30% for anyone that owns more than 5 acres of forest land. The eligible land for these tax credits are lands that are highly underproductive, that don't have a manageable stand of timber on them right now. Any stand of timber that has a manageable stand that is harvested is required to be reforested by the Forest Practice Act. Those lands are not eligible for this tax credit. The lands eligible for this tax credit generally are covered with brush, thatch, broom, blackberry, old pasture land that once was forest and now is being converted back to forest, or hardwood brush that has very little value. So the landowner is able to convert those lands and collect the tax credit to help offset that cost. Now the cost of actually converting those lands can run anywhere from $200 to $500 per acre, and of course the landowner cannot reap any benefit of that for another 15 or 20 years, and sometimes in the lifetime of the landowner. So without the tax credit, a lot of those lands are not being converted. And I have also attached here a chart that shows the number of acres that have been converted over the life of the tax credit on attachment 2, and attachment 3 shows the number of tax credit dollars over the life of the tax credit. So I would highly recommend that we would maintain this in order to convert those unhealthy productive forest lands into suitable lands, not only for timber purposes, but also for wildlife purposes. Thank you for your consideration, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I am one. I'm a city girl, and I constantly struggle making sure I understand the timber issues. I'm noticing that a lot of folks are planting cottonwood trees as sort of a paper, brick paper manufacturing process. Would this tax credit be applied in those situations?
Representative Rest, I think those are generally not eligible for this. If the timber is carried beyond the 10-year rotation, then they could be eligible. But the short rotation that normally they are harvested, they are not eligible for this tax credit.
Okay. I'm just trying to make sure I'm really trying to understand this one. The idea is that you might be a landholder and it's been scrubbed since it's been harvested, could have been harvested in the 30s, and nobody's come back in and replanted, and this credit is just sort of encouraging people to go in and replant that area. What's the land being used for if it's not being apparently used for trees? I mean, what else are people doing with this land?
President Grafton, a lot of times it's just sitting there, and the people don't realize the full potential of that land, and so it's just growing blackberry, scotch broom, and not being utilized for any real purpose. Unless they understand the potential of it, they don't know that they can produce a lot more than that land. And then when they understand the potential of it, a lot of times they can't afford to plant the trees.
So would it be of interest to them to then sell the land to someone who can plant the trees? Or I mean...
It might be of interest to them. But here again, it'd be difficult to find someone that really could afford to do that because we're talking a long-term investment and quite a bit of upfront cost. And so the thing that makes these lands eligible for conversion is the fact there's no revenue on it right now. Some of the lands do have a little bit of scrub timber on them, and they can be salvaged. And some landlords look at that, the salvageable timber, and along with a tax credit, and they say, well, okay, if I can break even, then I can convert those lands. So it's a matter of economics that allows these lands to be converted. And the tax credit is a big incentive to do that.
Follow-up question?
Sure.
Where, is there, this land sort of concentrated in any particular area of the state? Do you see this land as being evenly dispersed around the state?
President Rasmussen, there's a lot of acres concentrated in Douglas and Jackson County.
That are small holdings and non-replantable.
Yes. There's about 500,000 acres in Western Oregon, and most of that concentrated down in Southern Oregon.
Thank you.
Okay, Mark, I'm so sure. Thank you, Mr. Rutledge. I get that these are designated forest lands. Is that correct?
Representative Merkley, they may be designated forest lands, or they may be pasture lands that at one time was forest. It was converted to pasture many years ago, and now the landowner would like to convert them back to forest lands.
If they're designated forest lands, then the owner is already receiving a significant 80% reduction on their property tax. Is that not the case?
Representative Merkley, if they're designated forest land, then the owner may be receiving a 80% deferral on the property tax until they're harvested. Well, the problem with that is there's nothing to harvest there, so the county will then not be able to collect any money. And so if they're converted to productive forest lands, and then they can raise the crop of timber, which is valuable, and then they can pay that 80% property tax that's been deferred.
Well, technically, it's not deferred. I think I agree with that. No. There's no technical deferral of the 80%. It's just a 20% collection, and there is no ledger kept on the other 80%, if you will.
President Merkley, that's technically correct.
Mr. Okay, you were one of the two people who disagreed with that definition.
What's in the house?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other 54 people agreed that the privilege tax was deferred property tax.
But there is no ledger that's kept track of that amount. It's paid in the form of a privilege tax.
That is a kind of an intriguing twist of our timber history. Well, I guess I just wanted to... I was a little surprised that what you've said is pointed out that people can qualify for the tax deduction on their property tax even if they're not actively using their land as forest land, that is, they haven't replanted it as forest land. And it's just an intriguing point that hasn't come out in previous testimony.
And then, Merkley, a lot of these lands were actually purchased by people that had nothing to do with the past history of it. And when they purchase the land, they can't afford to plant it in the trees. And what we're after is trying to get that land back into a healthy productive forest And so we look at the lands itself to determine the eligibility.
Mr. This is a question which is probably not the more complex dialogue when we have this session, but as to whether the 80% reduction should be contingent upon using the land as forest land rather than letting it lie fallow.
If it's zoned forest land, it'll be used as forest land.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mifflin, the statute now requires that. Unfortunately, there's no one out there or not enough people out there to enforce that. And the legislature hasn't seen fit to fund that enforcement.
Thank you.
Mr. Rutledge, in your written testimony says that you go back after 2 years and look at this in order to continue to qualify. So could somebody be raising Christmas trees, for example, and still qualify for this tax credit?
Mr. Chair, no. Christmas trees are not eligible. Only a forest that's going to grow into a timber-type forest. And we do go out and look at it in 2 years to make sure that it is still there, because you can plant a plantation and lose a considerable amount of those trees. And if that's the case, then the land has to replant, and we go back and make sure that there is a stand of timber that's going to be there for the future. Christmas trees are not eligible.
But they could grow trees for 6 or 8 years and then cut them down, and we wouldn't know about it, I suppose, for Christmas trees.
Mr. Chair, I suppose that might be possible, yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Ledger?
Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, I'm John Ledger with Associated Oregon Industries, and I'm here today to talk briefly about pollution control tax credits. Just a little bit away by way of background on these, they've been around for about 30 years, and it's a tax savings program that goes to manufacturers primarily. And in this state, it'd be metals, food processing, high-tech, forest products, wood products. Just about anybody that makes anything can utilize these credits. Typically, these are companies that pay pretty good wages. For instance, the average wage in the high-tech industry is around $51,000 a year, and pump a lot of money into the economy and our schools. About 90% of the tax credits go to facilities located outside of Portland. Certainly, some of the Portland facilities used them, and they were instrumental in the air quality improvements we've seen there. But the benefits to this program are scattered around the state, very often in rural areas that are somewhat depressed. The tax credit program right now is due to sunset as far as applications go when you apply after you've constructed at the end of 2001. And since a company's planning process might be 3 years, might be 4 years, might be 5 years, and the tax credit is instrumental in what they do, that is expand or build here, we have many companies that have built this into their plans for expansion, and they see it in the law as lasting until at least 2001, and they've predicated their construction and their facility plans on that. A lot of these tax credits are given out. Sometimes it's been as low as a couple of dozen a year. Sometimes it's been as many as 400 a year, different facilities receiving the tax credit. Tends to gyrate fairly wildly, and I expect looking at a graph it reflects somewhat federal requirements on pollution controls. So in a nutshell, what we have here is a program that benefits the rural areas, good for the environment, and its companies have located here and are making plans now to use these, and by reducing them or cutting them off before the statutory date, I think that would be viewed as unfair by many companies. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ledger. Are there any questions of the witness? You've answered them all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jack Monroe. And I don't see Lynn McNamara in the room. The other counts are checking out in the hallway. Give me a second. The other senators?
So does that mean we can get rid of all these other tax credits since nobody's here to testify on it?
Where are you?
Over here.
Hello.
Hello. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lynn McNamara from the League of Oregon Cities. I'm sorry, my testimony is a little dated, but we'll work from there. Oh, we appreciate the chair's leadership and the members of the committee's willingness to discuss property tax exemptions. If all of the exemptions that were considered under this bill were to sunset, you'd be adding about $5.5 million back to the tax rolls. That's a small amount when we look at the total value of property tax exemptions, but it is a welcome start. Unfortunately, I can't recommend to you that we do yes, no, or maybe on any of these exemptions because the League hasn't taken a position on the specific exemptions before you. Our Finance and Tax Committee of the League, which looks at these issues, is planning to undertake a study during the interim to be able to make recommendations to the next legislature should we be asked to do so. But I did want to provide you for a couple minutes with the League's overall perspective on property tax exemptions in hopes that it'll be helpful to you as you look at these and others in the future. It would be easy for us to say that all property tax exemptions are bad and that all bills that remove property tax exemptions are good. While the effects are consistent with regard to the effects on local government revenue, it's really not that simple an issue from our point of view. Because it relates to what we want our tax system to accomplish and how we're going to go about doing that. At the bottom of the first page of my testimony is the League's position on property tax exemptions that was adopted as part of our Oregon municipal policy. And we look at that annually and was last reviewed in this past November. If I were to summarize it, I'd say the League supports understanding the financial and tax policy ramifications of property tax exemptions. We would like the opportunity for local governments affected by the exemptions to approve them at the local level. And if the exemption is imposed by the state or federal government, we think compensation to local governments to offset the cost of services provided to the exempt properties and to minimize the impact on other taxpayers is warranted. Attached to my testimony is a chart that lays out the possibilities and the questions that we think should be asked in looking at property tax exemptions. As you see, they suggest that first question you should ask is there a serious problem to be addressed by the exemption? And is there a problem that should be solved by the government? What policy objectives will the state achieve? And you can classify that in any number of different ways. Is the property tax exemption the only means to achieve that? And if so, what are the alternatives that you might look at? How it will affect the equity of the tax system? What conditions you may impose on the approval? How you will evaluate the policy achievement? And at what point you may look at it to sunset? How much will it cost, both in taxes and administrative charges, for the state to administer it? And then how will the decision be made and what happens if it's at the local level or the state level? A couple of weeks ago, when we were talking about the tax incident study, Professor Bruce Weber from Oregon State talked about how one makes judgments about fairness in the tax system. And he noted at that time that the analysis that the tax incident study will provide, and I'm quoting him, does not shed any light on whether those tax burdens are fair without some prior notion as to what burdens should be. I think one of the biggest challenges that we face in looking at these and other tax issues is a lack of clarity about what we want the tax system to accomplish, either in providing services, in changing behavior, or in the various other...
and put it under the Silver to Sunset, you'd be adding about $5.5 million back to the tax rolls. That's a small amount when we look at the total value of property tax exemptions, but it is a welcome start. Unfortunately, I can't recommend to you that we do yes, no, or maybe on any of these exemptions because the league hasn't taken a position on the specific exemptions before you. Our Finance and Tax Committee of the League, which looks at these issues, is planning to undertake a study during the interim to be able to make recommendations to the next legislature should we be asked to do so. But I did want to provide you for a couple minutes with the League's overall perspective on property tax exemptions in hopes that it'll be helpful to you as you look at these and others in the future. It would be easy for us to say that all property tax exemptions are bad and that all bills that remove property tax exemptions are good. While the effects are consistent with regard to the effects on local government revenue, it's really not that simple an issue from our point of view, and because it relates to what we want our tax system to accomplish and how we're going to go about doing that. At the bottom of the first page of my testimony is the League's position on property tax exemptions that was adopted as part of our Oregon municipal policy. And we look at that annually and was last reviewed in this past November. If I were to summarize it, I'd say the League supports understanding the financial and tax policy ramifications of property tax exemptions. We would like the opportunity for local governments affected by the exemptions to approve them at the local level. And if the exemption is imposed by the state or federal government, we think compensation to local governments to offset the cost of services provided to the exempt properties and to minimize the impact on other taxpayers is warranted. Attached to my testimony is a chart that lays out the possibilities and the questions that we think should be asked in looking at property tax exemptions. As you see, they suggest that the first question we should ask is there a serious problem to be addressed by the exemption, and is there a problem that should be solved by the government? What policy objectives will the state achieve? And you can classify that in any number of different ways. Is the property tax exemption the only means to achieve that? And if so, what are the alternatives that you might look at? How it'll affect the equity of the tax system, what conditions you may impose on the approval, how you'll evaluate the policy achievement, and at what point you may look at it to sunset, how much will it cost, both in taxes and administrative charges for the state to administer it, and then how will the decision be made and what happens if it's at the local level or the state level. A couple of weeks ago, when we were talking about the tax incident study, Professor Bruce Weber from Oregon State talked about how one makes judgments about fairness in the tax system, and he noted at that time that the analysis that the tax incident study will provide, and I'm quoting him, does not shed any light on whether those tax burdens are fair without some prior notion as to what burdens should be. I think one of the biggest challenges that we face in looking at these and other tax issues is a lack of clarity about what we want the tax system to accomplish, either in providing services, in changing behavior, or in the various other things that the tax system can do, and how we've made about the choices we've made up till now about taxation fit into the expectations, and how we're going to analyze and anticipate the future effects of changes in the tax system. We would suggest that just as the time has come to look at all of these tax expenditures individually, so has the time come to look at all of our tax policies, state and local, in a larger context. Your recommendation to go ahead with the tax incident study is a big step in that direction, we think. We urge you to continue on that path and look forward to working with you as you do. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you this morning. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you, Layla. If I understand your testimony, it's don't do it again. Let the local governments decide if they want it. And your firm may be on all the other issues as far as the repeal.
The League just hasn't taken a position on specific exemptions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Let's see. Is John Powell in the room? He's been waiting.
Okay, Bob, this time now. By the way, and I should correct the record, Representative Merkley reminded me that he was not one of the two people to vote against that timber bill on the floor. I think you did vote against it in committee, though.
Yes, it is.
That you spoke against it. I stand corrected.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Bob Castagna representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. Here, very briefly, to ask you not to attach a sunset clause to the state-earned income tax credit for working poor families with children. That first piece of legislation was introduced in the 1989 session of the legislature, and we went through five sessions of the legislature before it was adopted finally last year in 1997. And I would be reluctant and remiss to want to come back here every two or four years to have to argue for that credit, particularly in the aftermath of welfare reform. Welfare reform, as you know, was intended to move people from welfare to work, and we're doing that, and we've just begun with this tax credit, which piggybacks on the federal earned income tax credit for working poor families with children. I would just say that that has a meritorious public policy purpose, and if that needs to be revisited in a session or two down the line, that would be fine, but by attaching the sunset clause, then we have to argue for it and work that bill through the process, which, as you know, is much more difficult than just maintaining a program in place. So that's our appeal to you to not apply a sunset clause to the state earned income tax credit.
Thank you.
Being the one who was trying to attach sunset clauses to everything that I could possibly hook a sunset clause onto, I just want to reiterate to you that my thinking behind this is not so much an immediate decision on whether or not this program should continue or go away, so much as it is a philosophical attempt. As long as we have term limits and we have complete turnover every 6 years, that I think the state of Oregon has served if we take an opportunity to look at every tax credit every 6 years, so you continue to decide if this is still doing what you want it to do or if it needs to be changed or modified. And I'm not looking for a full employment act for yourself, but I am looking for a review every 6 years, not every two or four.
My question, Mr. Chair and Representative Rasmussen, would be in the construction of the budget, if that sunset were to occur on June 30th in the year 2003, as the 2003-2005 budget is being constructed, because there is a sunset clause on the state earned income tax credit, and let's just project for hypothetical sake that at that point it's a $20 million impact. Will that $20 million be budgeted by the executive branch of government as they prepare for that legislative session, or are they going to say, well, this was a sunset on a worthy tax credit, so therefore we'll reserve this $20 million for the continuation of that program, or will that $20 million be gobbled up in appropriations by that executive branch of government leading into that session? And then we, as the Human Service Advocates, have to come back to the 2003-2005 period there in the in that legislative session and then try to carve out the $20 million to recreate the funding for that tax credit. It took five sessions to get it here in the first place. And that's what I'd be concerned about. But by attaching a sunset clause, that money may not be there to continue that program.
Mr. Chair, that's a very valid point. The governor must build a budget based on current law. And if that particular year, or that, as you move into a particular budget year, if that credit is going away, everybody has the opportunity to go back in and rediscuss the credit. And I know it was a struggle to bring it forward, but I still feel that the underlying principle of periodic review is worth the impact on everyone concerned. And that's just to let you know that's that statement.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rasmussen, and philosophically, I guess I would not be in disagreement with you. But when I look at the child care credit and when I look at the state earned income tax credit, if those monies are not appropriated in a typical session debate, such as you're having this session, about funding for education, it is very easy, as we have seen session after session, for those of us who argue for programs for poor people to wind up on the short end of the stick. And that's what I'm concerned about in terms of public policy. I don't want to see poor people pitted against education. We can have the discussion, and the discussion is a philosophical one. Is it a good program? But if the reservation of those funds is not there, poor people often wind up left out. That's my experience in my 15th year representing the conference and trying to be an advocate for the poor in this, before this body.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I also do not wish to see education pitted against human services or education pitted against higher ed or against prison building. I think that that is part of the tension of this place in these decades. It is part of our reality.
Mr. Chairman, Secretary Winston. Mr. Castagna, the state earned income credit to date is not refundable. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, that is correct, although you have had before you, and I've testified before you earlier in the session, on House Bill 2051, which would potentially turn that credit into a refundable credit.
Can you follow, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
So to the extent that the credit is applicable under current law, all it is doing is returning taxes paid by low-income taxpayers back to them. And it's also true, I believe, is it not, that the Oregon income tax kicks in at very low levels of income.
Mr. Chair, Representative Webb, that is correct.
Okay, thank you very much. Jack Monroe.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I understand that I was called earlier, and I apologize for not having been here. I've been in another hearing, so.
Okay, we've only had this up for 3 or 4 days.
It has been sort of interesting scheduling oneself for an appearance here. I want to appear to briefly, I think, discuss two items that are on your long list of tax credits. Item 1.146 and item 1.148, both of which relate to insurance. The first one, 1146, is the fire insurance credit, a longstanding provision in the Oregon statutes. And basically, as I understand it, and I haven't certainly been back to the archives to check on the history, but I think sometime in the 60s it was determined that in order to provide the fire marshal's office with a source of income, and I guess the alternative would have been coming back to the general fund on all occasions, some insurance tax money was sent in that direction, and basically it is money, a tax that relates to fire insurance policies and multi-peril policies that have some fire insurance component. So, for example, your homeowner's coverage, which has a fire insurance component, I prorate a share of the tax that would be allocated to that. That premium is directed toward the fire marshal's office and the operations of that office. And that portion that is sent in that direction is a credit against the taxes that would otherwise be owed. And so that's kind of the basic system. The whole insurance tax system is somewhat complicated, and even maybe more complicated because we're in a transition period. Historically, domestic Oregon companies were subject to the corporate excise tax, and foreign companies were subject to a premium tax. And as a result of litigation relative to the constitutionality and the inequality of those two taxes that the discussion with the mayor, at least some of you who are here prior to 1995. A change was made in 95, and now both foreigns and domestics are subject to a corporate excise tax, although we're now in a period of transition. So, at any rate, obviously we believe that the fire insurance tax credit that's here is justified, that it simply represents money that was diverted in a particular direction, and it's a credit, if you will, in the account for that money that's been diverted. The second of the items that I would comment on briefly is the 1148, which is assessments paid to the Insurance Guarantee Association. And unlike, for example, a situation that might occur when a Future Shop or Smith Home Furnishings or some other entities go out of business and the party who purchased an appliance the day before finds out much to their disgust that that's occurred in the insurance area, when a company becomes insolvent, the rest of the industry has a mechanism that exists to make sure that the annuity policy that somebody bought a week ago or the auto accident that they had yesterday is one that they end up being compensated for, with some limitations that are in the statute. There's a maximum exposure of, I think, $300,000 that exists there. A guarantee fund is the mechanism that makes sure that those contractual commitments are in fact delivered. Every state in the country has one. They're basically a product of the 1960s, when a number of insurance companies went under, predominantly in the automobile area. They are... the administration of the entity is covered without any tax implications by the industry. But when a company goes under and when the assessments are paid to cover that company's obligations, those assessments are in fact subject to a tax credit over it's an assessment offset over 5 years. And that's the program that has been in existence for quite some time. I would say that of the other 50 states, as I indicated, they all have guarantee funds, with the exception of two of them. They all have some kind of recoupment mechanism to allow companies that have paid assessments, again, to handle the obligations of the insolvent company. And the recoupment mechanism is either allowing you to build that immediately back into the rate base, or allowing some sort of tax credit, as is the case in Oregon. Clearly, we support the continuation of this program. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair? Just a second, Mr. Shirley. Jack, were you also going to talk about 1.149, assessments paid to life and health?
You know, Mr. Chairman, I was not, because the entities that I represent are generally property and casualty associations. I know that there is a letter on the record sent by John Mangan of Standard Insurance, who is the president of the Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association, which is a similar, the mechanism is the same, it just deals with different lines of insurance. And but I was not planning to speak directly to it. I think that the mechanism is the same, the program is the same. I think the reason that you see the larger numbers here, and I'm not familiar with their operation, and I'm not a quantitative person, but I think some of you would recall that there, in fact, have been some life and health failures in recent history for Southwest, Equitable, and so I believe probably that the numbers here represent, again, assessments that were made to cover those obligations, and those assessments are still being credited, if you will, using that five-year mechanism.
Commissioner Shetterly. Mr. Chair, I just want to say I was ready to support the credit, but he got so long, I think we ought to
cut it just to make an example.
Well, I can read a cue when I strangle the
parent. Mr. Chair. I did want to ask you, the stuff around, you all are assessed for the state fire marshal, and that's still ongoing?
Mm-hmm. Every year, as I say, and there's a formula that it's like 100% of the premium for strictly a fire policy, and there, you know, are a few fire policies that are still written in commercial situations. Most other policies are, you know, multi-peril with fires and one of the exposures there, and again, it's X percent of the premium tax that would normally be paid, and it ends up being diverted into the
Well, it seems to me that maybe it does make sense to eliminate that particular credit and allow the fire marshal to come back into the general fund.
I mean, that's obviously a different kind of consideration, and clearly I'm not either here to nor probably able to adequately defend the fire marshal's operations and the funding mechanism that you selected.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
John McCulley.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCulley. Speaking, I assume I can talk on both of the measures?
Okay, and I'm assuming that you're going to say keep the tax credit.
That would be a very good assumption, Mr. Chair. First, I'll be representing the tree fruit industry, talking about the farm worker housing lender tax credit, 1.128. You've heard a lot of testimony on that already, and I just wanted to add the voice of those in the industry who participate in that program to lend our support for maintaining that credit as a way to help provide better housing for farm workers. At the same time, I was intrigued listening to a testimony, I think it was last Friday, when the committee, I think, asked questions concerning the construction tax credit that isn't on your list. About expanding that and eliminating the lender tax credit. And I could tell you that our folks might be interested in that approach because of the need for the construction end of it and the obvious, according to the report, lack of use of the lender tax credit. So that may be an option that would be worth pursuing. I'll also tell you that we have a bill that's been introduced, House Bill 3297, that was referred to the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee with a subsequent referral to this committee related to construction for farm worker housing, and there may be some opportunities to look at the program in that bill if it ever gets to you.
Mr. McCulley?
Yeah, 1.128 is not in the bill. It's not one of the ones that even mentioned, but 1.129 is.
I'm sorry.
They both talk about farm worker housing. One is farm worker housing construction. The other is the farm worker housing lender's credit, which is being used in less than $100,000.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. I looked at the wrong number. It was 1.129 is the issue I was testifying on.
Mr. Chair? What was the number of that bill that you were just referring?
House Bill, Mr. Chair, Representative Kapori, House Bill 3297.
Thank you.
Thanks. The next one, I'll switch hats here, Mr. Chair, and talk to you about in House Bill 2949, 2.024, which is the fairgrounds exemption. I am representing the Oregon Fairs Association,
and naturally, I'm speaking in behalf of retaining that exemption. This exemption was put in the statute in 1987, and Representative Aglon from Klamath Falls introduced a bill to address an issue that was occurring in Klamath County. The original bill exempted totally fairground property, but was narrowed by the House Revenue Committee at that time to just include the current items that are in the statute, horse stalls, RVs, and farm equipment. It passed during the 1987 session, I believe, with only two dissenting votes in both houses, and we believe it has had a valuable impact on smaller counties. The reasons for the bill passage in 1987, and I think still valid today, is the fact that in many counties this would involve taking money from one pocket, putting it into another pocket, and without really having a net impact on the county. What I'm saying there is if you tax the county fair, you take that money and then go through the budget process and give it back to the county fair. And that would occur in some of the counties where this would be in effect. County fairs are charged in the statute with managing those properties for the benefit of the public. And as funds are removed that allow them to meet that statutory mandate, it becomes very difficult for them to provide for the public benefit. One other reason that I think the exemption needs to be maintained is the possibility that the tax that would be collected could actually be higher than the revenues received for any of the rentals for the RV equipment and the farm equipment. As I understand the procedure, that the entire buildings and grounds would be added to the tax rolls, and in many of the smaller counties, that actually could require a higher tax paid than is received in rent, so the rent would probably go away. This impact would be greatest in smaller counties. Tillamook, I think Polk, Sherman, Gillum are the counties that are primarily doing this type of activity, and it is the way that they can generate revenues in those counties where they don't have opportunities like larger counties do for the fairgrounds to be used for other purposes. So for those reasons, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we would urge retention of this exemption.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman,
I'd just like to put on the record my strong support for county fairs and for this particular tax credit.
Because you want to kill the state fair.
Any other comments?
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
John Powell.
Thank you. That's hard. I was trying to find my way back.
That's funny. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell. Before you today, representing Nucor Corporation. House Bill 2947-1 repeals the rural enterprise zone provisions in the statute. Last session, we were able to modify those laws to allow for a tax credit to attract a major steel mill in the Coos Bay area. Currently, the negotiations on property and power transmission lines and the like are currently underway to hopefully get the infrastructure into that area so that that mill can be built. The legislation that we passed was targeted to chronically unemployed areas, areas that basically had a 10% or greater unemployment rate. Obviously, that's not the Willamette Valley, so it would not apply to Portland, Salem, Eugene, those areas specifically to try to get these developments into rural areas. This particular plant would employ 250 people immediately. Their average salary ranges in the 50,000 plus
area for their line workers. So this would be a major boost to the economy of the South Coast, and we are currently working on how the tax credit works. Is that basically they would be responsible for the first $1 million in corporate excise tax. They would pay that. They would have up to a 15-year property tax exemption. And of the $1 million per year they pay the first $1 million in corporate excise tax. 300,000 of that goes to local government. So that was split off for that one particular tax credit. Again, at that tax rate, this corporation would be one of the 40 largest corporate taxpayers in the state of Oregon, even with this tax break. So we think that it was a reasonable effort to target specifically the non-urban rural areas that were suffering from high unemployment. And that bill passed with very, very strong bipartisan support. There was controversy.
In smaller counties. Tillamook, I think Polk, Sherman, Gillum are the counties that are primarily doing this type of activity, and it is a way that they can generate revenues in those counties where they don't have opportunities like larger counties do for the fairgrounds to be used for other purposes. So for those reasons, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we would urge retention of this exemption.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Ripley Williams.
I'd just like to put on the record my strong support for county fairs and for this particular tax credit.
Because you want to kill the tax fair.
Any other comments?
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Powell.
Thank you. I'm trying to find my way back.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell. Before you today, representing Newcourt Corporation. House Bill 2947-1 repeals the rural enterprise zone provisions in the statute. Last session, we were able to modify those laws to allow for a tax credit to attract a major steel mill in the Coos Bay area. Currently, the negotiations on property and power transmission lines and the like are currently underway to hopefully get the infrastructure into that area so that that mill can be built. The legislation that we passed was targeted to chronically unemployed areas, areas that basically had a 10% or greater unemployment rate. Obviously, that's not the Willamette Valley, so it would not apply to Portland, Salem, Eugene, those areas specifically to try to get these developments into rural areas. This particular plant would employ 250 people immediately. Their average salary ranges in the 50,000 plus area for their line workers. So this would be a major boost to the economy of the South Coast, and we are currently working on how the tax credit works. Is that basically they would be responsible for the first $1 million in corporate excise tax. They would pay that. They would have up to a 15-year property tax exemption. And of the $1 million per year they pay the first $1 million in corporate excise tax. 300,000 of that goes to local government. So that was split off for that one particular tax credit. Again, at that tax rate, this corporation would be one of the 40 largest
corporate taxpayers in the state of Oregon, even with this tax break. So we think that it was a reasonable effort to target specifically the non-urban rural areas that were suffering from high unemployment. And that bill passed with very, very strong bipartisan support. There was controversy, some of it stemming from public employees unions who opposed the tax credit, but on the other hand, it was supported by legislators such as Senator, at the time, Senator Randy Leonard. And so we had good, strong bipartisan support for that bill, and as I said, the negotiations on the project are currently underway. And so we would hope that that particular provision would not be repealed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Powell. Any questions?
Thank you. Just to clarify, it looks like it does have a sunset date attached to it already in the law.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, that's correct. It does sunset. Not only does it sunset, but the governor has to approve the tax credit. So it's got several safeguards in it, specifically to make sure that it's a project that would meet standards. They also have to invest in this particular project, the way the bill's written now, a minimum of $250 million, employ at least 100 people at a rate of 150% of the average wage in that county. So again, this was written with very high standards, and there's legislation to modify that somewhat, this session, not at our request, and we tried to make it very clear that we intend on staying at those high standards. There are many impediments to development in that rural area. For example, not enough power to run mills like this and other developments. It's not just this mill, but that end of the coast is simply under infrastructure. And there's another bill in this session to try to get a natural gas line into Coosa. So those are very important to the development of that area, which is hurting. But we're immune from that. We live here in the Willamette Valley and get run over by people making potholes down there. They would invite that.
Getting run over by potholes?
No, people creating potholes. I'm sorry. I haven't been passed by one lately.
Pothole. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, is there some kind of a requirement for this credit that the area in which the facility is placed must be economically depressed? Is there some kind of threshold in terms of unemployment that has to be met or some other statistical threshold?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. It has to be in a county that qualifies for a title of chronic unemployment, which has standards that are established by the Department of Economic Development. And there are probably 10 counties maybe that currently qualify, many of them on the east side of the mountains, of course, and then a few on the Gulf Coast.
I don't think, just editorial observation, I don't think the analysts from economic development did a very good job in explaining that. It sounds very generic rather than mentioning these projects specifically. Obviously, the bill did not mention those projects specifically, but I think in their analysis, EDD could have pointed that out.
And Mr. Chairman, let me also qualify this by saying that probably the reason they didn't is there is a generic rural enterprise zone bill that has, I think, a 3 to 5 year property tax credit, that sort of thing. And so they're probably most directly referring to that, the more generic one. But it's still, the Rural Enterprise Zone bill is still targeted to try to get development into those sectors of the economy that have not been prospering in the last few years.
Thanks very much. Is anyone else in the room who wants to speak? How many? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Whoa. We have 10:45 floor session, so... go ahead and we'll see how far we get, and then we'll have this up one more time. Maybe less than that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Donald Lamb, and I'm speaking today, maybe perhaps, but certainly one, as board chair for St. Vincent de Paul Society of Lane County, Inc., specifically dealing with affordable housing. The alternate energy devices, that is your 1.141 and 1.143 in the Hong House Bill 2947-1 is very, very useful to affordable housing. And what we do creatively with that is that we take those credits and turn around and talk to the distributor and people, since we're a nonprofit, the tax credit doesn't help us. But we're able to transfer those credits whenever possible to get a reduction in price, which in turn creates equity and to drive the rents down to make affordable housing truly affordable. In the Lane County area, we have a project called Bluebell, in which we were able to, Bluebell project is for 10 units, and it's renting for a two-bedroom, is renting for $420, and a three-bedroom is renting for $460. We put solar devices upon the projects to drive down the rents again, not the rents, but the utilities for the individuals, because people, obviously, that are low income, whether what you pay for rent together with utilities or your cost of your housing. So these tax credits are very, very useful to us, and we would like to continue to, should we say, creatively use them for the affordable housing project. Likewise, on that same basis, the low-income housing, the 4% loan for lenders, which is on page 135, apparently sunsets in December of 99. That likewise is used by us, and we're currently using it on one of the conversions of Section 8 housing now that the landlord, the owner, wants to sell at market prices. We're picking that up and utilizing that with Bank of America and KeyBank to put the permanent mortgage on as far as the portion of the purchase price that is going to be able to be financed to create the a basis for the establishment of rent. So we need that one along the same way. The other hat that I would put on at this time is the hat for the Oregon Catholic Conference, and that's dealing with two measures. Your 1.123 and 1.124, which are the child and dependent care and working families. Those bills are extremely important for low-income families that are working at basically poverty level and have three or four people in it. Those credits are essential for them, and I think and just for good public policy, they should be continued. And certainly, if you've been over in the human resources side, on the child care side, one of the major things that's constantly being shared is the cost of child care and how it's necessary for when you're a working mother or a poor family that they need that. So I think part of what we're about is to be sure that these things are available to those that are attempting to stabilize themselves. And that's the end of my testimony.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gentleman back here. Yes. Right behind you. Right behind Ted. Yes. Yes, you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brent Henderson. I'm the president of the Sunrun and Fire Company in Portland. I'm a supplier in the solar energy industry, and I'm here to speak on just this alternative energy tax credits and business energy tax credits. I'll be just as brief as I can. The fact is, when you are in favor of renewables, you're a very good crowd. It is a very accepted technology. A lot of people want it. We're rooting for it. I don't know anyone who stands on the side and wants more oil imports and more air pollution and things like that. And it's nice to see in Congress in Washington, D.C., we have a thing called the House Renewable Caucus, and we have over 140 members, and it's pretty much equally divided between both parties. And again, it's a kind of a thing that can bring us all together to try to figure out and solve a problem, which is air pollution and imports of fossil fuels and so on. So having a domestic industry that can build clean energy here domestically, locally, and even export these technologies is something that is good for the state, and I think it's good public policy for the state, and the public is behind it, and they will they remember, they like this stuff. So I appreciate your efforts on this, and hope to see you in the future.
What was the specific credit you're talking about?
I believe it was 2954. That's the home residential alternative energy tax credit. And I believe there may have also been one on property tax exemption for renewables, and then the business energy tax credit. Those are all very positive for the renewable industry.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Any questions? Thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
Mr. Hughes.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Ted Hughes, representing this morning the Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. My testimony this morning is more like a public service announcement. Please view it that way. We're talking about, we'd like to point out to you the 1.130, the involuntary mobile home moves tax credits there. What we wanted to say about it was that every place that these manufactured home parks are, the land is going up and up and up and getting more expensive. And we can see in the future, for example, the manufactured home park that sits on the Columbia River by the Red Line as converting to high-rise condos and apartments. And if I were a legislator in that area, I certainly would not want to be there when they manufactured home park tenants were told to leave because the land is being converted. So this I would say, if I were a legislator, I would enhance this program. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Any questions? Thanks. Jim?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Craven with the American Electronics Association. Two facts before I go into the defense mode here on a couple of credits that are before this committee. According to the March forecast, corporate taxes in Oregon for the current biennium 1997-1999, I took this off the March forecast, were $575 million. Projected for the 1999-01 biennium, $832 million, which my calculator says is a 45% increase in corporate taxes. While we continue to look at the shift analysis and the tax incidence study, and I think those are all, you know, worthy things that we ought to look at, it is not true that corporate taxes are going down in Oregon. In fact, according to the governor's tax review during the interim, corporate taxes between 1992 and 1996 more than doubled. And we're talking about receipts, not percentage of the pie or shifts or all those good numbers, but from a historic, a trending line of being about $150 million a year between 1992 and 1996, went from $162 million to $350 million. Just to make the point up front that corporate tax receipts have been exploding in Oregon over the last few biennium, and of course that's what triggered a large corporate kicker. But net receipts, money in the bank, money in the general fund for us to spend on worthy projects have been going up from corporate sources. In the Standard Industrial Code 36, which includes semiconductors, which includes Intel Corporation, of course, corporate taxes between 1985 and 1994 went up 1,611%. That's a 10-year trend. And just one other number, between 1980 and 1996, the specific SIC code that includes semiconductors alone, receipts went up, payroll between 1980 and 1996 went up 832% in the state. That's money in people's pockets as a result of industrial expansion. The only reason I use that setup is to say that are the various tools in the pocket that Oregon has as far as business tax incentives, do they play a role in that? We think so. Are they a definitive role that one can necessarily prove on a one-to-one basis? Perhaps not. But by creating a positive business climate in the state, we've seen what the results have been. Huge increase in payrolls and huge increase in corporate receipts to the general fund. So having said that, I'll just mention four credits that are before you and let you go to session. The research and development tax credit, which is only a credit for companies who increase their spending on research from one year to the next. So it's not an entitlement, it's only for net increases. The computer donation tax credit, again, which was expanded and extended last session by votes of 26 to 2 in the Senate and 54 to nothing in the House. So that was not only broadened, but also extended on the sunset date just last session. I would echo earlier comments on the pollution control tax credit, and a number of our firms have worked with the Department of Energy on the BETSI program, the Business Energy Tax Credit. So those four, I guess I want to put a plug in for, and a fifth that's been brought to my mind by a couple of my companies is the Employer Dependent Care Assistance Program. We've got a number of our companies that have on-site daycare centers. Secret Computer Company is one out in Beaverton. We have another one getting started, Electro Scientific Industries in Cedar Mills. Those companies, I think, rely upon the financing of that credit to do something that I think is in good public policy, which is to provide subsidized on-site daycare center for the workers. So that's my testimony, and I appreciate your time.
Great. Are there any questions? Colleagues, we have two more folks to bring up. The chair is going to start the session. We are excused. If you have stuff you need to do on the floor, you need to do what you need to do. But we do have Paul Cosgrove and Catherine Benetta.
Madam Chair, there was City Paul Cosgrove representing the American Forcing Paper Association, and because of the time, we were very brief. I'm here to testify in favor of retention of pollution control tax credit, and I would like to just provide one piece of information that I don't think has been given to you about that program in prior testimony from others. Our industry, especially the pulp and paper side, has been a major beneficiary of this tax credit since 1967, and some of the biggest credits awarded under this program, which were our industry. We're very familiar with the program. Many of those big credits were awarded as and classified as complying with air and water quality standards. And in fact, that is technically true, but what has happened in our industry, as you're well aware, is we have moved from an industry reliant on virgin fiber, primarily from Oregon sawmills, to an industry that is substantially, and in fact, in some cases, entirely reliant on recycled fiber. That's because we don't have virgin fiber that we can get anymore for a variety of reasons, of which you're all aware in terms of the change in the Oregon economy. And in order to keep those plants running, which were built here because of virgin fiber, we had to transition them to recycled fiber. In many cases, that transition required us to meet new standards. We could have chosen not to transition, gone after scarce virgin fiber or shut down. We did not. We wanted to keep our investment and our workers in this state. So we made the transition. That was a voluntary act. But because of that transition, we imposed upon ourselves a variety of new standards. And so in terms of the classification at the Department of Environmental Quality of whether we were required doing required things, that's the category we fit in. I would suggest to you that that kind of move in this case is something that is
not the same as simply a standard is imposed, everybody has to comply, and somebody gets a tax credit for it. It really is a different kind and nature of project, and that's why I wanted to mention that to you. As I say, I think in the last 5 years, the largest credits issued under this program have been to pulp and paper plants, and they were all because of that kind of transition that is still ongoing in the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Catherine Vanatta, Governmental Affairs Manager for the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. I echo Paul's comments, and I urge the retention of the pollution control facilities 1.135 and the business energy facilities 1.142 tax credit. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you for your patience, and we are in tomorrow.